Hello, thanks for downloading this podcast of The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We're on the radio, too. Radio, you know, that thing with the crank in your emergency kit. Radio. Well, it sounds a bit like this.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Thank you so much for listening. A look at how the Boston bomber could pay with his life for his crimes, plus the ongoing fight to reclaim ground from the self-proclaimed Islamic State. But first, to retain their strength, ISIS has launched an English-language radio news series, bulletins broadcast on the Al Bayan radio network, along with updates in Arabic and Russian. Here's how the first broadcast began, and note here the American accent.
We thank our listeners for tuning in and present the following Islamic State news bulletin for Tuesday, the 18th of Jumad al-Akhirah, in the year 1436 of the prophetic Hijrah. We begin with our most important headlines: the killing of a top commander in Jaish al-Tahrir in the Yarmouk refugee camp, and the Islamic State's battle.
The terrorist group already has a monthly English language magazine called Dabiq, and both news sources publicize ISIS brutal attacks and murders, calling for more martyrs to join the fight. Now, it appears to be part of a broader propaganda strategy aimed at attracting young members from the West. But the question is, who is ISIS really reaching here? For more on these propaganda tactics, we're joined now by Firwaz Yirjaz, professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. He's also author of The New Middle East, Protest and Revolution in the Arab World. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
A new radio station in Iraq broadcasting in English on behalf of ISIS. Who are they reaching with this?
Well, out of the 35,000 fighters that we think ISIS has, you have almost 25,000 foreign fighters. So almost, 75%. The irony is that ISIS is more international than Al-Qaeda itself, which is Al-Qaeda is supposed to be borderless, transnational, dedicated to fighting the far enemy, the United States and its European allies, while ISIS is basically supposed to be local in Iraq and Syria, dedicated to fighting the local enemy, the Syrian and Iraqi government, yet it's much more international than Al-Qaeda itself. And since we're talking about, new radio, Al-Bayan, what we need to stress here is that propaganda, social media, traditional media like Al-Bayan are the fuel that really powers the recruitment strategy of ISIS. So it's a very, very pivotal instrument used by ISIS to attract foreign fighters from all over the world, both the Arabic, the Russian, and the English-speaking world.
It's understandable that with so many foreign fighters, English would be the common language that ISIS would want to use. Is this an FM signal within Iraq that's for fighters there on the ground in Syria and Iraq? Is there an internet component that could reach young people in England or the United States?
Well, I think mainly in Iraq and Syria. But remember, they're using Twitter. So, the Al-Bayan radio station is really basically designed for the followers and supporters of ISIS in both Iraq and Syria, with some of the potential recruits basically outside Iraq and Syria in particular in the international system using the Twitter accounts. One point here is very important about why now, why in English? In the last 6 months or so, ISIS has suffered major setbacks, in particular in Iraq. And the news bulletin in English and Russian and Arabic is supposed to basically respond and also reassure followers and supporters that basically ISIS is standing tall. If you listen to the various bulletins, they talk about the new progress that they are making in Iraq and Syria. They talk about their suicide bombers. They're talking about basically inflicting a great deal of damage on their enemies. So it's part of the international campaign and also trying to get its own narrative both in Iraq and Syria and outside.
Well, that's interesting, Professor, because it sounds like actually a slightly different message than what they've targeted towards young people in the West. We've seen lots of slick videos, lots of Twitter activity, and even magazines that present to young people in the West kind of a fun adventure, join the jihad, do something new, be part of something. This broadcast, which is for fighters that are already there, is about keeping the faith, talking about successes, minimizing setbacks, really for people in the battle already.
It really is. I mean, the radio station is basically for the hardcore ISIS fighters in the field, you know, in the trenches, whether in Syria or Iraq, reassuring basically the hardcore fighters that ISIS is surviving. ISIS is making major headway in the fight. It's not losing. The setbacks are basically temporarily. So in this particular sense, it differs from the slick videos that we have seen over the last 1 year or so. And the irony here, it's not just in Arabic and English, in Russian. You might say, really, why Russian? A few people realize that Russian-speaking fighters are some of the most important fighters within ISIS, in particular the Chechens and other former members of the former Soviet Union countries. And this tells you, again, to come back to this particular point, it really tells you a great deal how international ISIS is. It really has changed the strategy, propaganda used by terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda Central.
Fawaz Jerjes is professor of international relations at the London School of Economics. He's also author of the forthcoming book, ISIS, A Short History. Professor, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
ISIS may be pursuing a bolder propaganda strategy, but the Iraqi army and its many helpers continue to fight back, with Iraq's prime minister calling Wednesday for a major offensive against the group in the city of Ramadi in Anbar province. Ramadi is a city of 200,000 people. It's been under siege by ISIS for more than a year, and residents there face a daily barrage of mortar shells and car bombs and sniper rounds. Vice News correspondent David Enders traveled to Ramadi in early March to see what life was like in the shadow of ISIS.
Some of the groups in Anbar that previously backed the U.S. or fought with the U.S. and fought on the side of the Iraqi government that was backed by the U.S. now find themselves largely abandoned. Not entirely abandoned, but they're sort of stuck between an American presence that won't help them directly and an Iraqi government that effectively doesn't really trust them, as well as the Islamic State, which has surrounded the capital of Anbar province, which is Ramadi, and taken over most of the province.
All right, well, let's go on the ground in Ramadi, because that's what you did in your piece for Vice. I want to play some audio from one doctor that you met up with at a hospital that you visited, talking about the situation in his hospital and the patients that he sees. Listen.
Every moment we are suffering. Because, you know, once you go outside your home, you don't know whether there is a bullet in the air, whether there is a car bombing beside you. Once you came to hospital, you face so many problems regarding the electricity, shortage of fuel, the oxygen, tap water, etc., etc.
Every moment we are suffering, he says to you, David. What is the situation today in Ramadi?
Well, for much of the last year, the only electricity has come from generators. It's difficult to get normal things in, food. When you see what's coming into Ramadi, it's mostly cooking gas and very basic supplies, food. And what you see going out of Ramadi and Anbar is a lot of people. We visited the hospital, the main hospital there, where the doctor talked about just shortages of things that they need to treat some of the traumatic injuries that they're seeing more frequently since the Islamic State moved in about a year ago.
In many of the cities that Islamic State has taken over, we've seen draconian crackdowns on the local population, Islamification, executions. I could go down the list. I think many of us are familiar with the horrors that ISIS has wrought upon the places that it's conquered. So have any of those tactics come down on the residents of Ramadi so far?
Not necessarily on the residents of Ramadi, but certainly in some of the outlying areas. As the Islamic State took over, the outskirts of Ramadi or different areas of Anbar, those tactics were used and people did flee. We were actually in Ramadi, there's sort of a strange situation. You can actually cross back and forth between Islamic State-held neighborhoods of the capital and neighborhoods that are considered contested and the government-held areas. And what they describe is just a more severe lack of services mostly. They're basically crossing over to get food, to sometimes collect paychecks. The governorate is in some cases still paying government employees. And one reason for the Islamic State maybe not to have taken over all of Ramadi yet is because once that happens, they would probably begin shelling the city from outside, which is happening in Fallujah, which just happened in Tikrit, and images of some of the destruction there have been on television.
You spent some time with the governor of Anbar riding around in his convoy. You were at his compound. One of the many things that he lamented, aside from potentially his own safety, was that American airstrikes were kind of around a couple of months ago, but then had waned.
Yes. As we've seen most recently with the Tikrit offensive, pro-government forces in Iraq are generally not moving forward very far without U.S. airstrikes being in the lead. And that is the same thing they would like in Ramadi. And they've said that basically since the beginning of the air campaign, it's been focused elsewhere as opposed to Anbar.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Tikrit because that offensive to take territory back from Islamic State was supposed to be sort of a proof of concept. There was a coalition of Iraqi military, Shiite militias, Iranian elements, American airstrikes, all joined together, although allegedly not coordinating with one another, to take Tikrit, Saddam Hussein's hometown, back from Islamic State. Largely successful. Does that prototype example play a role for Ramadi? Does anybody think that the same type of coalition or same type of proof of concept, Iranian element, Shiite militias, is going to do Ramadi any good? Is it on the way?
That dynamic with having the very obviously sectarian militias that are fighting on behalf of the Iraqi government present in Ramadi, and some of them are present in Anbar already, backing up what the Iraqi army, quote-unquote, which often their units have a very open sectarian bent as well. And we'll see what happens in Tikrit. It certainly remains to be seen how they'll keep the city quiet after this, whether or not they'll even let people necessarily return in great numbers, and who they'll allow to return and who they won't. So just because they've entered the city in Tikrit and a lot of the city has been very badly damaged doesn't mean things there are even far from over. So, you know, the building up of these sorts of tensions is going to inevitably make it more difficult for the Iraqi government to recapture these areas.
David Enders is a producer for Vice News. He spent 3 days in Ramadi. His new piece up on Vice.com, Under Siege in Ramadi. David Enders, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We're continuing our series, Political Science, Where Evidence and Ideology Collide. And today we have a look at the inner workings of how policymakers interpret scientific data and how politics plays a key role in that. General Barry McCaffrey is a retired Army four-star general. He was an infantry commander in the first Gulf War. And from 1996 to 2001, he served as the U.S. Drug Policy Director under President Clinton. That means he was the drug czar. In October of 1996, just months after McCaffrey was sworn in as drug czar, he was called in to testify on Capitol Hill on the war on drugs. At the time, a Republican-controlled committee accused McCaffrey of suppressing a study by the Pentagon, finding that it's more cost-effective to burn cocaine fields and bust drug couriers in Latin America than to reduce demand by treating addicts here in the U.S. Now, McCaffrey, to this day, says that the science was on his side.
This is a very complex town, as you know, and I think a lot of the political viewpoints were either ill-informed or ideological or stupid. And I say that because, you know, when I started, there were studies floating around. People grab a study in Washington on policy in general. They haven't read their own study. They wave it at the other side and said, if you read this study, you'd know why I'm right and you're wrong. And one of the, on both sides of this issue, there was a big study that essentially said for every dollar spent on interdiction, you get seven times more effect from the dollar spent on treatment. But there was an opposing study. One of the first attempts to wreck me in a congressional hearing was just prior to the Clinton's reelection campaign, and the contention was at this hearing, which fortunately was on C-SPAN. It was the most ludicrous hearing imaginable. But essentially, the contention was that I was going to lie to the American people and tell them that only treatment worked and that interdiction didn't.
Here is General Barry McCaffrey testifying before a House subcommittee on October 1st in 1996. Republicans wanted to know if McCaffrey supported drug interdiction in South America or treating addicts in the United States as a matter of priority.
Let me ask you this. Do you agree with the substance of the report?
No, not at all.
And nothing in the report at all?
No, wait. I think what I would agree with is that good interdiction pays off.
The politicians who were challenging you on that, only interdiction works. Why were they doing that? What do they got going on that they have to confront you in that way?
Some of them were ill-informed. Mostly in that case, it was a deliberate attempt to damage Clinton in the upcoming presidential election. That was going on. They actually told me prior to the hearing, said, Barry, we're sorry we have to do this. The leadership told us to try and dust you up a bit. And if you survive it, they said, we'll be glad to work with you in the next administration. This actually was what grown men were telling me. It sort of amused me. I've been shot at by people in combat. I said, what do you think this is going to intimidate me? So there was a lot of that going on.
So you're coming with them, let's say, with a policy that says we need to increase drug treatment.
Well, the first...
And they tell you, we know you're right, but we got to beat you up because of Bill Clinton.
Well, a lot of them didn't know I was right, I might add. They were also ill-informed.
General Barry McCaffrey on the behind-the-scenes jockeying over a scientific report on drug policy, how what we know can easily get distorted when political agendas are at stake. Well, then, in 1997, Democrats in Congress introduced a measure of their own. They wanted to free up federal money for needle exchange programs.
And this year, in April of 1997, a recent poll by the Terrence Group found 53% of respondents approved needle exchange to help prevent HIV transmission.
That's Representative Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, speaking on the House floor in September of 1997. Now, conservatives strongly opposed any move to change a ban on federal money for needle exchange.
Now, the president should be clear. If he thinks that needle exchanges are good, why is he not paying for them? And he's not paying for them because he knows the Congress won't tolerate it. And this is one more example of General McCaffrey's difficult job. He has been assigned the position that is the equivalent of Vietnam. He has the title. He doesn't have the power.
That's former House Speaker Newt Gingrich speaking before reporters in April of 1998. Well, powerful members of Clinton's cabinet wanted federally funded needle exchange. They said they had the science to show that it cuts HIV transmission. Now, I was a Cub reporter covering the science policy beat and Barry McCaffrey at the time, and what happened next I never forgot. McCaffrey shocked other cabinet members by going to the president aboard Air Force One and convincing Clinton to pull the plug on needle exchange, a program that researchers say was working to cut HIV and AIDS. So here's Barry McCaffrey taking us inside his argument to the president and how policymakers fought over the science.
We were on a trip to Argentina. I was with the president on Air Force One. Of course, the drug issue was huge around Latin America, and I was helping him with that dialogue. And I found out there was a White House meeting, and they were going to announce that we're going to have federal support, administration support for needle exchange. I went to the president on Air Force One. Here he's sitting there, and I said, sir, let me tell you about this issue. I told him I was the only one that read all three studies. I'd been to Senatine Vancouver, that it was clear to me needle exchanges was the wrong way to go, that if it was my son or daughter who was a heroin addict, that I wanted comprehensive outreach programs to get them into treatment and that would succeed, whereas needle exchange, or for that matter, the Netherlands approach, giving people free opiates, with just killing them. You get killed by heroin addiction.
But spared HIV, that was the argument.
Well, the numbers weren't there. It was complete nonsense. Anyway, I said, sir, I've read all the issues. Now, the other thing I told him is, whatever you decide, I'm publicly supporting.
But you said, sir, I'm going to support whatever you decide.
Absolutely.
All of the reporting at the time was McCaffrey threatens to resign publicly and embarrass the president if he doesn't.
Never happened. Mm-hmm. Never happened. I personally told President Clinton with his face 2 feet away, whatever you decide, I'm supporting. By the way, from Air Force One, he called back and said, wave off the press conference.
Barry McCaffrey, retired Army four-star general, and from 1996 to 2001, U.S. Drug Policy Director for President Bill Clinton.
Coming up next, we're talking about the next steps in the trial of Boston bomber Jihar Tsarnaev. But first, we're asking you, should Tsarnaev receive the death penalty?
Hi, my name's Adam from Austin, Texas. The death penalty was made for cases exactly like this. There's absolutely no doubt of his guilt. And as such, there's no logical reason to keep him alive.
Join the conversation. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. There's more on our website at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you. Guilty on all 30 counts, Boston bomber Jihar Tsarnaev may now face the death penalty. That process begins next week, and it will be up to the jury to decide. For a better understanding of how that jury process will work, we want to turn back to Northeastern University law professor Daniel Medwed, who's also an expert in criminal law. Welcome back to the show, Professor.
Hello, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Is it the same jury that's going to hear the penalty phase of this trial as just heard the guilt phase?
The precise same jury, 7 women and 5 men who presided as jurors over the guilt phase, will also handle the mitigation or sentencing phase. There are 17 charges that are potentially subject to the death penalty. If the jury finds beyond a reasonable doubt on any one of those 17, Todd, then Mr. Tsarnaev will be sentenced to death.
So the legal standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, how does that work in the sentencing phase? He's already guilty.
Terrific. That's what happens. So at the guilty phase, he's found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt of the substantive charges, those 30 charges. Now at sentencing, the prosecution has to show more, guilt plus. They have to show that one or more aggravating factors are proven beyond a reasonable doubt. Some of the aggravating factors that might come into play, Todd, or whether this crime was committed in a particularly heinous, depraved, or cruel manner, whether it involved substantial planning or preparation, and whether any one of the victims was especially vulnerable. The prosecution will have to prove one or more of those factors beyond a reasonable doubt on top of the pre-existing guilty verdict.
So how does the defense strategy, which we've seen throughout this trial, of basically admitting Jihar Tsarnaev's role in these crimes, not disputing the charges, but putting the blame on the older brother, the radicalization on the older brother, Tamerlan, suggesting that Jihar was sort of a follower here and was influenced by his brother. How does that strategy play into this process that you're describing?
It'll play into this process, Todd, in the following way. The defense has to put on so-called mitigation evidence, evidence that suggests that the jury should spare him his life. And some of those mitigation factors are whether Jihar Tsarnaev was, quote-unquote, a minor participant in relationship to his brother, and or whether he acted under duress, that he was coerced by his brother. Since those are explicit mitigation factors under the federal rules, I anticipate that the defense team will continue to tell that story. Tamerlan was driving this bus, he was the dominant force in this enterprise, and Jihar was just a follower.
There's a question throughout this trial, Professor Medwed, that I've been wondering about as we've seen this defense strategy of effectively admitting to the charges but going for these mitigating factors. Has Jihar Tsarnaev personally shown any indication of wanting to fight for his life?
Such an interesting question. We don't know. We don't know. If he wanted to die, if he wanted to volunteer, as it's called to be a volunteer, then presumably he would inform the defense team about that and they would cease and desist and there would be a very different strategy. So we can infer that he is willing to fight for his life. And in fact, even when you look back at the events of the Marathon bombing, these weren't suicide bombers. There was no exit plan. He didn't commit suicide by cop. There's a reason to think that he does want to live and he's fighting the charges.
And the chances that we see him take the stand in his own defense in this sentencing phase?
Oh, I'd say slim to none, Todd. There's so much to lose here. We don't know how he'll play in front of the jury. Thus far in court, he has not appeared, to the lay observer at least, to be especially remorseful. A lot of people have commented on his callous or cavalier affect. So I think there's a lot to risk by putting him up on the stand. He might come across as cavalier to begin with. And in addition, he would then be subject to withering cross-examination by the prosecution.
The guilt phase of the Boston bombing trial is over 30 guilty counts. 17 of them could lead to the death penalty. The next phase of that trial begins next week. Northeastern University law professor Daniel Medwed, thank you for walking us through it.
Thanks so much, Todd.
And we put this question to you. What punishment do you think would be just and fair? From Morristown, New Jersey, since murder is not solved by murdering someone, I say life in prison. You can weigh in too. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We usually think of our morals as universal. Certainly, plenty of philosophies in most religions say that, a set of right actions and guidelines that make us uniquely human, right? But in his latest book, Ian Morris, who's a professor of classics at Stanford University, argues that like any other part of us, morals evolve, just like height or brain size. Throughout history, how you live, in other words, determines what you know to be right. Today, Morris argues, the freedoms we cherish and our belief in equal rights for all are really just byproducts of living in a fossil fuel economy. Ian Morris's latest book is Foragers, Farmers, and Fossil Fuels, How Human Values Evolve. And he told me that one of the marvels of the fossil fuel age is just how very safe it is.
When you compare modern societies, like say, you know, look at the world in the 20th century, 100 to 200 million people die violently in the 20th century. That's a mind-boggling number. And yet, the other side of the story is that somewhere around 10 billion people lived during the 20th century. So this is a rate of violent death about 1 to 2%. If you go back to the Stone Age, people who lived in the Stone Age are dealing with rates of violent death in the 10 to 20% range. So they're 10 times more likely to die violently than we are today. In a sense, you know, we're no less into killing each other now than we were 20,000 years ago. But I think the big thing that has changed is the way we organise our societies, which ultimately is driven by the way we get the energy from the world. And when you are a forager, you know, you live in these tiny little groups, there's no police force, it's nothing like that. And so if you and I fall out having this interview and I get incredibly angry, I always have the option of killing you, you know, coming to New York and just killing you and settling our problem that way. And if I do that in the 21st century AD, I know there's a really good chance I'm going to get arrested, thrown in prison. The state has all its force at its disposal to punish me for what I did. Back in the Stone Age, that just isn't the case. As the societies get more complex, it gets harder and harder for them to function with high rates of violence. So in a foraging society, you've got a lot more freedom to settle your disputes violently. And you can carry on being hunters and gatherers while there's quite high rates of violence going on around you. But when you start moving toward a farming society, that gets more difficult. You know, you've got crops, you've got your fields, your irrigation systems, your houses, whatever. If every time people fall out, they're running around burning each other's houses down and smashing, you know, cutting down each other's crops, this becomes a problem for the rulers of the society. They're not going to get as much in taxes. They're going to be weaker relative to their neighbours. So they come under pressure to pacify the society they rule. And in modern fossil fuel societies, this is even more true. I mean, you know, you couldn't have Wall Street functioning if everybody's killing each other every few minutes. You couldn't have a big factory making things. Again, if you every time there's a labour dispute, people pull out guns and start shooting each other. So these pressures build up for us not only to develop these institutions which make it harder to go around killing each other, but also that reward people, the pressures reward people who start to say, you know, violence is just wrong. You know, violence is not the morally right way to solve our problems.
So I wonder, Professor Ian Morris, if there's a contradiction or a reinforcement to your ideas in the current state of the world where industrialized democratic societies like ours that are based on fossil fuels shun monarchy, we like capitalism, we like freedom, but we get our fuel, not exclusively, but we get a large amount of our fuel from societies that still value monarchy, that still have kings, that are still oppressive in our view. Does that reinforce what you're saying? They're basically our farmers and we've gone on and industrialized?
Yes, this is fascinating paradox, but it's not a unique paradox. We see things like this happening a lot through history. Before the oil is discovered, Middle Eastern societies are among the most traditional in the world. And of course, what we've seen in the last few years has been these very rapid changes in values in the Middle East, great uprisings against the dictatorships that were set up there after World War II. Of course, you know, nobody knows exactly how the Arab Spring is going to turn out, but this level of violence and rapid change and some very radical Democrats, very, very strong, very conservative backlash against them. This is the sort of thing we see over and over again in the world where societies begin to change really quickly.
Now, let's talk about the future, because the fossil fuel age
is close to at an end, whether it's because of global warming and climate change or just depletion of resources. We know that the coal and the oil is limited. It can't last forever. And to the extent we have a future, it's based on solar power and wind power and sources that I guess are much more ubiquitous than just where the oil is underneath Iraq and Saudi Arabia. What does that mean for the future of this society based on your what I call moral Darwinism?
Yeah, I think one of the implications is there's nothing permanent about the way that most of us in the industrialized democratic world think about what values should be. You know, values have changed before. The chances are they'll change again. If I'm right that the big driver has been the way we extract energy from the world, which shapes the kind of societies that flourish, which determine what kind of values will do well, then it's a very good chance that we're likely to see enormous changes in values across the next 100 years, as we are, it seems to me at least, as we're now going through another energy revolution. So the big question is then, well, okay, so what are these new values going to look like? And I think the answers, you know, very much depend on where you think the big changes are taking us. And I think one of the biggest things that's going on in the world today is the way we have invented these machines, this technology, particularly computing technology, digital technology, and we've begun to merge with this technology that we've created. And in a sense, we're almost becoming new kinds of animals, like, you know, computer-assisted humans. And it's easy to see one way in which this could lead toward a much more egalitarian, kind of flatter world. You know, people increasingly merge with their machines, the boundaries between people break down. But I think you can also see ways in which it could go in the exactly the opposite direction. And some individuals, some rich people, begin to merge with technology, begin to have, you know, enhanced brains, and the rest of us are becoming increasingly unnecessary to this new kind of human being. And maybe, you know, as happened repeatedly in the past with biological evolution, a small group of people are basically going to replace the rest of us. The world will become more and more unequal. Or then again, maybe something completely different is going to happen. But however it turns out, I think we're living on the cusp of the biggest change in humanity in the last 100,000 years. And I'm pretty optimistic. I mean, I think all of the trends we see suggest that the more egalitarian future is the direction that we're heading in. But I think it's no easier for us to see the future than it would have been for foragers 10,000 years ago to see what the farming world was going to be like.
So maybe an optimistic vision of the brave new world that is ahead of us. The book is Foragers, Farmers, and Fossil Fuels, How Human Values Evolve, the author, Professor Ian Morris of Stanford. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
And here's something to take with you today. Washington, D.C. is welcoming spring. With the blooming of the cherry blossoms, those blooms have officially moved to the puffy white stage as of yesterday, according to the National Park Service, and that means that peak bloom is just a day or two away. The 3,000-plus trees came to the Capitol in 1912. They were a gift from Japan. Today, they draw in about 1.5 million visitors every year to the National Cherry Blossom Festival, along with more than $100 million tourist dollars. And that's just for the trees down by the Jefferson Memorial. Those of us who call D.C. home love the fact that we've got cherry blossoms all over town. Well, that's all for today. But if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. It's a great way to stay up on the news. You can find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts fixed. And you can ask me anything on Twitter. I'm at Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. I am Todd Zwillick, and this is The Takeaway.
Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. The Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.